Don't you just hate coming into the middle of a story? Somebody's got a joke that they're telling, they're in the middle of this story, and you can tell everybody's really into it, and there's some nitty-gritty details that you can already tell that there's interesting parts that have already happened that you didn't hear, and you're like, well, what's going on? Like, you just want to get caught up. I'm not very good about this when I'm watching TV shows and my wife comes in late and wants me to catch her up. Lord, give me patience. Pray for both of us in those situations. But we always feel like we're missing some crucial details, right? We're not sure that we understand why everybody is upset, or we just want to know what happened. Well, I'm going to do that to you this morning. That's right. It's almost as bad as that video with the truck where you didn't quite get to see it crash. I sent that to one person, the finish of that video. They were happy. They were very satisfied. We're gonna jump in to Luke chapter 20, 19 through 26, and we're right in the middle of a story. You're welcome. Verse 19. The scribes and the chief priests sought to lay hands on him being Jesus, at that very hour, for they perceived that he had told this parable against them, and they feared the people. You know what parable it is? No, you don't know what parable it is, because I'm throwing you right in the middle of a story, all right? It's my prerogative. I get to do this. But the parable that Jesus just told the people, he's going through all these different stories. It was not a good look for the religious leaders. They're correct when they sussed this out. They assumed that in the parable Jesus just told, they were the black hats, not the white hats, right? And they weren't wrong. Jesus didn't make any bones about it. He was using a very direct example. He was very direct and scathing at times with the religious leaders. And they were tired of losing to Jesus. The chief priests, the scribes, and the Pharisees, they were the prevailing religious leaders of the day. They were the fundamentalists. They prided themselves on being experts at everything Torah-related and in the traditions of the fathers. And it was their thing that when it came to the law and the traditions of the fathers. And whenever there were religious lawsuits of any kind, usually they were the ones that were called in to be the expert witnesses. But then you have this guy, this newcomer, this upstart come along who taught, in Matthew 7:29, it says, as having authority not of the scribes or not as the scribes. That didn't sit well with them. You know, he taught as if he had his own authority. And that was offensive. It was infuriating and insulting for them, because when they taught, when the scribes and the Pharisees, whenever they taught, they had to quote other people all the time. It's kind of like when kids say, well, Dad said I could have the remote, right? They're quoting an authority which gives them authority. Jesus, in contrast, just spoke with his own authority. He didn't quote other people because he didn't have to. He is the authority. And for these religious leaders to be handed repetitive defeats at the hand of Jesus was humiliating and deflating. It hurt their reputations. And if they could have just taken him away at that very moment, because it says that very hour, but that translates into immediately they wanted to grab him and take him away and get him out of the picture. But they know that the people would riot if they tried it. They loved Jesus at this point. They loved his teaching. They loved his message, his demeanor. They loved that it seemed like Jesus stood up for everyone equally. Gender didn't matter to him. Nationality didn't matter to him. Race, age. He was accessible by anyone. And it didn't hurt That he was also sticking it to the religious leaders who were prideful and heaped these burdens on the people that they could hardly bear. I'm pretty sure that the general population relished the fact that Jesus was getting the best. He was getting the better of the religious leaders. So they didn't dare try anything right now. So they retreat to their lair of doom, right, to scheme, and they come up with a plan that they think is going to work. Verse 20. So they watched him and sent spies, so tricky, who pretended to be sincere that they might catch him in something that he said, as to deliver him up to the authority and jurisdiction of the governor. So since openly attacking Jesus isn't working, they failed. They covertly try to trap Jesus in his words. For the same story is recorded in Matthew and Mark. They both also tell this same story. We know that the people that they sent to go trap Jesus are, there's two different groups. There's the Pharisees and there's the Herodians. The Herodians, we don't know a whole lot about. They're only mentioned twice in the Gospels. What we do know is that they were fiercely loyal to Herod and that they were more of a political group. They weren't really a religious group as much as they were political. Which makes sense considering the nature of the trap that they're about to set for Jesus. Now, verse 21, they asked him, "Teacher, we know that you speak and teach rightly, that you show no partiality, but you truly teach the way of God." Now that is pure hogwash. Not that all those things that they said about Jesus are true, that's not what's hogwash. What's hogwash is that they believe it. They're just shining him on is all they're doing. They're using this flattery to try to butter Jesus up. They start out with these compliments, hoping to not draw suspicion to themselves as these plants who are there to try to trap Jesus. They don't want to alert him and make him suspicious. You know why we know it's not true? How we know that they didn't really believe this? Because if they believed it, they would follow Jesus. They wouldn't be trying to trap him in this moment. So they're not sincere. They're dirty, rotten liars is what they are. So let's get to their question. Because it is clever. I'll give them this. Is it lawful for us to give tribute to Caesar or not? So this question is what's called a dichotomy. A dichotomy is this literary device used to make a clear distinction between two different things, giving them opposing qualities. It comes from a Greek word that literally means to divide in two. And it's the idea, it forces you to make a decision of one thing or the other. Doesn't mean that they have to be opposites, but that they are put into opposition or a clear distinction between the two. Some common ones are male and female. It's a dichotomy. They're not opposites, although sometimes it feels like it. But clearly there is a distinction between those two, real and imaginary. If I have a real friend or an imaginary friend, not the same thing. Body and soul, good and evil, civil or savage. Those are all dichotomies where there's things that are, there's a dividing line between the two. The intent of a dichotomy, again, is to create conflict or to force a choice. Now, the thing that I find a little bit ironic about this tactic that they're using is I think they learned this tactic from Jesus. Because we've got this parable, again, we're jumping right in the middle of this story, but the story that he tells, the parable that he tells that was so offensive to them that causes them to want to kill him, the story that leads to that story. So we're backing up two levels, right? They ask him this question in their normal tactic, just right up front and ask him this question. He says, "I'll tell you what, I'll answer that question, but I'm going to ask you a question first. If you answer it, I'll answer your question." This is from Luke 20, verse 3 through 8. He says, "Was the baptism of John from heaven or from man?" So it presents this dichotomy. Is it one or is it the other? And they discussed it with one another, saying, if we say from heaven, he will say, well, why didn't you believe him? Right? It's a valid question. If John's message that they should be baptized is from heaven, they should follow God's commands. But if we say from man, all the people will stone us to death because they're convinced that John was a prophet. So they answered, we don't know where it comes from. Right? Chickens. Right? And Jesus says to them, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. He trapped them, right? He presented them with this dichotomy, knowing that there was no good answer. He knew that that's what they would do. There was no good answer where they could come out winning in that, so they just didn't answer at all. He gave them a no-win scenario. So in my head, when that happens, and then that next parable where he makes them look like the bad guys, because they are the bad guys, just time and time and time again, they've lost to Jesus. I think they go back to their secret lair. They're trying feverishly to figure out a way to beat Jesus at all of these mind games, which this is what comes to my mind. In my head, they have all these glass boards with dry erase markers and wadded up pieces of paper everywhere. There's like tons of coffee that they've been just burning through. As they're trying to figure out, we've got to figure out how to beat this guy. Until one of them says, well, why don't we use his own tactics against him? Ours aren't working. Let's beat him at his own game. So they set about figuring out a question that would, no matter how he answers it, he's trapped. And that's the reason why including the Herodians was important. They're a key element of this trap that they set. If Jesus says, in answer to this question, do not pay taxes to Rome, he's in trouble. That is insurrection. And the Herodians would be there as witnesses. They could go tell the authorities to come, and he'd be taken away. Problem solved, right? But if he says, pay the taxes, he would lose a ton of favor with the Jewish people. I mean, nobody likes paying taxes, right? Show of hands of who likes paying taxes. Yeah, nobody likes paying taxes. And the Jews especially hated paying taxes to Rome. If Jesus endorsed it, it'd be a blemish on what was so far the spotless record. And so the religious leaders are thinking about this. This is a win-win. So they think. But Jesus is on to them. Verse 23, he perceived their craftiness and said to them, this is what came to my mind. All my Star Wars nerds will appreciate this. It's a trap. I was told that somebody has this as their ringtone or their texting. Heather, that's awesome. Jesus is on to him. He figures out that he knows that their intentions, what their intentions are, and he shimmies and fakes them out in this masterful way. They give him this either-or question, and he gives them a both-and answer. So he asks for a coin. He's going to do this object lesson. Show me a denarius, verse 24, whose likeness and inscription does it have? They said, Caesar's. They probably spit when they said that, by the way. And wherever they spat, grass will never grow ever again. Then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And they were not able in the presence of the people to catch him in what he said, but they marveled at his answer, and they became silent. I think it's fair to say they didn't see this answer coming. I think that they really believed they had this one locked down, that they had painted Jesus into this pretty tight corner. They probably already had their victory cake on order at the baker, and they sent somebody, hey, go cancel the cake. Cancel the cake. But let's break down his answer a little bit. We've already seen their reaction. They're humiliated. It just shuts them up. They realize, we can't catch this guy this way. A Roman denarius was about the size of a dime. That's a picture of one right there. about the size of a dime, had the image of Tiberius Caesar on it. And the inscription that it would have, it said, Tiberius Caesar Augustus, son of divine Augustus. It's a mouthful, right? The arrogance of that. But he asks for a coin because in order to print, to mint money, that's a privilege of power and authority, right? Not just anyone can make money and put their image on it and then have that be, well, I mean, you can. I've got some money that I printed here. I've got a $10,000 bill with my image on it, right? Anybody want to take one of these and go out and try to buy something? Then I'll give you one here in a minute, Jacqueline. How about that? Yeah. Nobody's going to accept that. I mean, first of all, it's goofy looking. Oh, that's because I'm goofy looking. But there's no power. There's no buying power in this because I have no power to enforce it. Right? If you were to go somewhere and try to hand somebody one of these bills, just because my image is on it doesn't mean anything, but when his image is on it, and he's the emperor, all of the power of all of the government backs that coin, right? $20, you know, for us, like, I don't want to get into a discussion about the gold standard and fiat currency and all those things. That'd be a rabbit hole we could go down to for a while. But the basic idea is this. A $20 bill is worth $20 because the government says it has that value. For no other reason than that. And because they have the authority to do so. The first lesson that we see in this answer that Jesus gives them is this. Well, the first lesson we learn is don't mess with Jesus. Right? That's the first. If anybody learns a lesson from that one, you don't want to get into a war of words with the Messiah, right? You'll lose. But the second lesson, the one that is actually intended by Jesus, is this. You're not going to like it. Pay taxes. Nobody wants to hear that. And it's not the only time that Scripture actually says this. There are other places where we're reminded that we are to follow the laws of the land in which we live and respect the authorities in our life because all authority has God's backing. If you look at Romans 13, verses 1 through 4, it says, let every person, this is Paul speaking, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed. And those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval. For he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid. For he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, this is hard for us, especially in this, like, we're a fiercely independent community in this area. We must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. For because of this, you also pay taxes. For the authorities are ministers of God, attending to this very thing. Pay to all what is owed them. Taxes to whom taxes are owed. Revenue to whom revenue is owed. Respect to whom respect is owed, and honor to whom honor is owed. 1 Peter 2, verses 13 through 17. Be subject, again, there's that word, be subject for the Lord's sake, to every human institution. Whether it be to the emperor as supreme or the governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. Those are pretty clear directives given to us as Christians from the Word of God. It does have its limits. We don't follow blindly. We don't do whatever they say, no matter what they command us to do. Our country has a bit of a feverish obsession with our flag. Have you noticed that? We love our flag. And there's all sorts of etiquette to show the way that it's to be treated and how it's not to be treated, how it's supposed to be presented and how it's not supposed to be presented. If there's a group of flags all together, and the American flag is one of them, if they're all the same height, you know where the American flag is supposed to be? Farthest left, extreme left, because that's the number one position, right? We count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's supposed to be there. If it's in a group of flags and the center pole is higher than the others, that's where the American flag is supposed to be. God doesn't have a flag, but if he did, it would fly higher than any national flag. In a church, we do have an American flag. We have it over there, and that's the flag of the church, right? But it's not God. It's not really God's flag. He hasn't given us a banner to fly for him. But if he did, it would be to the left, and the American flag would be second. We have an obligation to follow the laws of our land. Our eternal citizenship may be somewhere else, but that doesn't free us to just pick and choose the laws we want to disregard and which ones to honor. If it violates God's law, we refrain. But sometimes that's still going to lead to consequences. Peter and the apostles still got imprisoned. So did Paul. Daniel ended up in the lion's den. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego still ended up in the fiery furnace. One time we read in Acts chapter 5 where Peter and the apostles get arrested for preaching the gospel. They get thrown in jail, and God miraculously frees them. So what do? They go preach again. And of course, the police come and they say, "Hey, you need to stop doing this." And their response, in Acts 5:29, is, "We must obey God rather than men." And that's the only time, really, for us to engage in disobedience to civil authorities. As Christians, we sometimes find ourselves in a position where conflicts arise between church and state. And by state, I mean civil authorities, not just Kansas or Missouri or Oklahoma, you know, the broader sense of the term. But here's where Jesus goes in this. He says, pay taxes. There's another story where he's asked a similar question about paying the temple tax. And they don't have any money to pay the temple tax. And so, remember what he tells Peter? He says, go catch a fish and open the fish's mouth and you'll find a coin. Peter does. He goes and fishes, and he catches a fish, and in that fish, there's this coin, and it's enough to pay the tax. It's cheating, by the way, I'm just going to say. But Jesus pays the tax. But that isn't the main point of our story, though, is it? The most important part comes next. Give to God what is God's. And that's a clear lesson in this illustration that Jesus is making. He's saying the reason why you have to give money to Caesar is because it bears his image, so it belongs to him. Whose image is imprinted on us? gods. Genesis 3, we read that God made man in his image. We all bear his stamp on each one of us. Romans 12, Paul says, I appeal to you by the mercies of God to present your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. I was reminded in my personal studies this week that when it says that the Bible is living and active, part of what that means is not only do you read it, but it reads you, right? It's not just that I read the Bible reads me. If I read it the right way, it evaluates my life and it reveals to me ways in which I need to realign my way with his way. Last week I mentioned this comment that sometimes people have conflict because when their beliefs and their behavior are in conflict, it's easier for them to change their beliefs than to change their behavior. Right? When they believe, they know that God says not to do this thing, but I want to do this thing, or I want to keep doing this thing, it's easier to change, to say, well, I just don't believe that it's wrong, than it is to just stop what we're doing. But changing our behavior is the only real choice that a believer has. Reality is the only choice that anybody has, because the idea of changing your convictions out of necessity or out of convenience doesn't really work anyway. It creates this thing called cognitive dissonance, which is a bit of a mouthful, but apparently our minds are averse to inconsistencies. And cognitive dissonance is used to describe the mental discomfort that a person has from holding two conflicting beliefs, behaviors, attitudes. The point is that as a Christian, our responsibility is to be humble and to be soft and to submit to the Word of God and be loyal to His desires over our own. Which is challenging sometimes, right? It is hard to follow somebody else's rules and desires over your own. Paul in Romans 7 talks about this. He says, I don't understand my own actions. I do not do what I want to do, but the very thing that I hate, this I do. Now, if I do what I do not want, I agree with the law that it's good. So now it's no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells within me. For I know that nothing good dwells in me, that is, in my flesh. For I have the desire to do what is right, but not the ability to carry it out. For I do not do the good I want, but the evil I do not want, this I keep on doing. Just because it's hard doesn't mean that we give in and we surrender to our flesh. We are to surrender to the Lord. In Michael Frost's book, The Forgotten Ways, he has this thoughtful piece on it where he talks about how when you read the Pentateuch, the law, the first five books of the Bible, you're immediately struck by this radically nonlinear logic associated with it. It seems to jump from one subject to another, from issues of sublime theology in one verse to seemingly trivial issues in the very next verse. One verse deals with the Israelites' approach to God in the temple. The very next verse is what to do when one's donkey falls into a pit. The next might very well do with the mildew in the kitchen, and the next with the female menstrual cycle. It seems to be radically discontinuous and generally lacks the sequential reasons that we look for when we read. What's going on here? How can we comprehend the meaning of this, he says. There is actually a rather profound and somewhat nonlinear logic in the Torah. A logic that trains us to relate all aspects of life to God. The implications of following the Torah faithfully will be to connect all things in life directly to Yahweh, to the Lord. Whether it be the mildew or the temple worship and everything in between. Therefore, everything, one's work, one's domestic life, one's health, one's worship, everything has spiritual dimensions. Here in the Western tradition, we have tended to see the religious as a category, as one category of life among many. But the Hebrew mind had no such distinction about a purely religious existence, but it was concerned with all of life. All of life is sacred when it's placed in a relationship to the living God. All of life belongs to God. And true holiness means bringing all of the spheres of our life under Him. This is what constitutes biblical worship. This is what it means to love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. It's what it looks like to render unto God that which is God's. We do this with our life. It's like this pie chart here where I have friends in one slice of the pie and my rest and my sleep in another and my schoolwork and recreational health. All those are things, we do this, and we divide it all up. But what we do sometimes is we say, all right, God, you can have this piece of the pie of my life. Right? On Sundays, that's yours. When I'm at church, Sunday nights even, if I'm in a home group, if I go to Wednesday nights, you can have that too. But when I go to work, that's mine. When I'm hanging out with my family or whatever I do on Fridays and Saturdays with my friends, my relationships, those belong to me. You stay out of that. You don't get to control that. You're here. But as Christians, we don't get to separate part of our life as mine and part of our life as God's, where He only gets the part where I go to church and I read my Bible and I go to my home group. They can stay out of my dating relationships, my movie choices, my music selections, my career, and how I use my spare time. Sometimes Christians will ask one another, you know, as an accountability question, they'll say, how's your spiritual life going? It's an invalid question. You don't have a spiritual life. You have a life. And all of it belongs to Him, not 30%. Not 63%, not 94.5%. All of it, we are His. And we're blessed because of it. Allow me to put it one more way. I've got just a little bit more time I want to use. When you think about somebody that is eccentric, like who's the first person that comes to mind? I've asked a few people this already, and I make the list, which is not a surprise. But aside from me, when you think about somebody, and preferably somebody who's famous or well-known, it could even be a character in a story, who's somebody that comes to mind that's eccentric? You have a picture in your head, right? This is who comes to my mind every time. Great Scott! You know? Doc Brown from Back to the Future. I mean, he's got all the gadgets and the weird hair, and he's probably got way too many cats somewhere. We don't know what's going on. Lives in a weird house on the top of the hill. Probably has broken cars everywhere. I don't know. But when we think about people who are weird and odd and strange, and if you're being nice, unique. You know what the word eccentric really means? It actually has, there's two parts if you break it down. There's ek and centric. And ek means out of, and centric means central or in the center. So the word eccentric literally means out of center. Oh, Oh, that's what you're supposed to do there, because it makes so much sense, right? Thank you. Oh, yeah, that's great, great. No. Come here. I want you guys to come here. They're going to help me out with this. One of the things that we tend to do with our life, okay, let's come over here on this side, is our natural, our default position is everything revolves around us. It's my life. Everything revolves around us. Here, take that one. Take that one. I'm not giving this to anybody in particular, so don't worry about that. All right? So, we've got all sorts of things. I got rest, friends, music, play, work, family, God, and all of that. Oh, this way. There we go. We work real hard. Make sure they can see it. There we go. All right. Yeah. You can tell we work real hard on this. Yeah. I'm going to get dizzy. You're going so fast. So this is how we live, though, right? Everything revolves around me. We don't intend necessarily to do this, but really what we're supposed to do is this. Could you go ahead and stop and come in the middle? Now, this is going to be really, really tricky. All right. No, it's not. I'm just kidding. Give me these. You guys are all good. Yeah, you're good. Stay there for a second. To be eccentric is actually the call of every Christian. Because what I'm supposed to do is, it's my responsibility to take myself out of the center of the universe, and God is in the center of the universe, and everything about me, see for just a little bit, revolves around Him. I take myself out of the center, and I put Him at the center of my life. And so, whether it has to do with work, or my friends, or how I rest, or my family stuff, all of my decisions have to be affected by the fact that my life revolves around Him. He doesn't revolve around me. He doesn't exist for me. I exist for Him. Thanks, guys. You guys can have a seat. Thank you. Oh, wait. Hey, about here. For your time, thank you.
Yay.
There you go. Thank you. Yes, thank you. Don't spend it all in one place. One of those schmucks doesn't realize they only got a fiver. What's that? The rental place? Yeah, possibly. You'd try. Hence the shirt, by the way. Thanks to Grace for my shirt. We're supposed to be eccentric. But we live with ourselves at the center, and we expect everything else to revolve around us, but we're supposed to revolve around God. And Jesus is calling, in this story, He's calling out the religious leaders, He's calling out the disciples, and He's also asking each one of us to be eccentric, to take ourselves out of the center and put the Lord there instead, for that's the only one who really belongs there. So my question for you today is, what's holding you back? Where are you refusing to turn over the reins to the Lord? What part of your life are you saying, nope, this is mine, you don't get to make the calls here. This is mine. You can't have it. Are you even aware that you are doing that with parts of your life, that you're keeping it from Him and shielding it from Him and trying to keep control instead of just turning it over? You might be surprised at how much of your life you haven't considered giving to Him. We'd do very well to become very familiar with the words of this prayer. I'm going to ask you guys to go ahead and stand. And we'll leave it up on the screen here. So you can take a screenshot of it. You can write it down in your journal. Do something so you could commit it to memory. Because this would be a valuable prayer for every one of us. Did I highlight that, Michael, or did I not? Okay. There we go. Thank you. Yeah, Lord, what am I tempted to hold back from You? Remind me that You never held Yourself back. I want us, we're going to pray this together as our closing. Remember, it's not a race. right? But I just want you to think about those words for just a second. We're not going to rush into it, but I want it to be an actual prayer. Don't just recite it because it's up there, but ask the Lord to reveal to you what are the things that you are keeping as revolving around you, but you really need to turn it over to Him, because we're to be eccentric. Let's say this together. Lord, what am I tempted to hold back from you? Remind me that you never held yourself back. Amen. Have a great and joyful spring break.